Bonk.
Dan.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. A little peek behind the curtain here. We've been spending what feels like the last 20 minutes watching two dogs rotate around on a couple beds on the ground, trying to get comfortable. They feverishly paw at... what are they trying to get done when they're doing that?
I don't know. Fluff the pillow. I don't know. They just like will paw at the bed to make it perfect.
Is that normal dog behavior? Or are they... Okay. I didn't know if we had two particularly...
It's normal, but they are especially particular.
Okay. All right. Well, they're doing good now. And you know what? They've been really good with the podcast behavior, certainly since we've been in this new pizone.
Yeah.
As opposed to the literal closet we podcasted in for a year.
Yeah.
Over
well,
a year.
I have fond memories of that closet.
I do too.
The pizone and, of course, the studio before that, which was just our bedroom in New York City.
Yes. And before that was just our bed.
Yep.
So we went from recording on the bed to recording in the bedroom to recording in a closet to now. It's kind of a joint pizone slash my office. Mm-hmm. So this is where the work gets done.
Yeah. This is a professional space.
It's a good size for an office type thing. You wouldn't want to put a bed in here. I don't think this is technically a bedroom, I think, but this would be a very tiny bed.
Yeah. I believe it was a bedroom when we... Was there a bed in here when we first looked at the house?
They had kids. I bet this was like a baby room.
Baby room.
Wouldn't you think?
Yeah, probably. It's a good size for that.
Yeah, yeah. We saw, we just did some Thanksgiving stuff at the in-laws there, and we have a couple of nephews. And they got both of them in one room right now. Yeah,
yes.
Because they're both tiny. They're less than a year apart.
Yeah, well, that's the only spare bedroom that they have in the house. Well,
right.
It previously wasn't a bedroom. It was like an office.
Now there's two human beings living in there.
That's
versus
right.
I don't know, staplers or whatever people normally keep in offices. yeah, that's interesting. Less than a year apart, our nephews. So that's going to be two boys. So that's going to be... I never had brothers. You had two older brothers. Mm-hmm. So the sibling experience we had was kind of literal opposites. I had two younger sisters. You had two older brothers.
That's right. Yes. And I believe my arrangement was the superior one.
Very different. I mean, my sisters, very close to my sisters. They are
your
they're
sisters
excellent,
are great. But I mean, I don't know. Granted, I only have my life as a point of reference, but the idea of having two younger sisters seems like a drag.
I would never describe them as a drag, but it wasn't like there was that closeness with brothers and stuff you always hear about, and I never had that really. And there was also like a huge age difference and everything. So I almost felt like I was like, I would like babysit them and stuff. You know, it wasn't like a close, like... We're talking about our nephews that are a year apart. You know, they're going to be like best friends and stuff. Where it's like, this is more of a like much older brother I was to my sister.
Yeah.
So,
well, closeness among sisters is a thing too. So I guess because we were the odd gender out, we didn't get that experience of like really bonding super strong with someone growing up. I mean, when I was a kid, my brothers would like torture me, like take my baby dolls and run down the stairs so the doll's head hit the railings of the stairs along the way down. And they would just, you know, lay all their weight just on top of me so I couldn't move. They would attack me and make fun of me mercilessly. But they also are the best. So, yeah.
See, I never had that antagonistic relationship with my sisters, but I wonder if I had a brother around my age. Mm-hmm. I wonder if we would have been more kind of punks about it, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure having like someone to gang up on someone else with just makes it way easier and more fun.
Well, and also we dealt with it in a healthy way in that we had Mario Party. So any antagonism that we had sibling-wise was, you know, hashed out on Peach's birthday cake.
That's cool.
Yeah.
We bonded over games as well, but it certainly was Mario Party.
It's Revolution X and Skies. Well, I mean, Skies of Arcadia was more a you thing, right?
Game. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Morrowind. And...
Yeah. Well, I mean, those are all my video games. Those are single player games. They had nothing to do with my brothers.
Were you ever a multiplayer person? Like, did you guys ever have like that, you know, multiplayer thing you would always play? Fighting games, anything?
Unreal Tournament.
Yeah.
That was the one that we would always go back to.
Yeah.
We'd always be down to play some Unreal. But and Soul Calibur, we would play Soul Calibur. These are both for the Dreamcast. But beyond that, I can't think of any like multiplayer games that we did together. There was a lot of like when I was really young, just watching Dan play video games and not actually playing them myself, which was kind of like a multiplayer activity.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's exactly how Kayla and I were for the longest time. And, you know, she's talked before, and she streams now on Twitch, and she's talked about how like she didn't really play a ton until I left for college. And she was like, oh, I love video games, but now I don't have someone to watch. So now she started like playing the Zelda games instead of watching me play them and everything. So yeah, that's a lot of very fun childhood memories of playing games, especially scary games, and Kayla and sometimes Katie watching. So.
Yeah, that's the very first iteration of Let's Plays were just younger siblings watching their older siblings play video games.
Yeah, good times for sure. This is all happening in the late 90s, I would say, would be the peak of that in the PlayStation and 64 era. And the late 90s turned out to be a very, very important pop culture time for this. Is a there was a hint of a segue.
Yeah, you were going so broad with it. I thought you were just going to say that we were so transfixed by the simulation on screen.
Oh, you know what? That's a much more elegant way to get there. Yes, folks, the Matrix.
That's right.
Yes, you may have heard that there is a new Matrix coming out after many years. I don't remember. I know it was the early 2000s. Both the sequels came out when I was in college.
Oh my God. I just thought of what would have been the perfect segue.
What is it?
But it's so specific that only a few people listening, those who played Unreal Tournament, would appreciate the reference.
For those of you out there, here it is.
Whenever I play, my main skin that I would always be was Matrix.
There you go.
Just like the movie we're talking about today.
There you go. All right. There's something for everyone here on Panning the Stream as we get to the Matrix. So here's what we're planning on doing.
No, let's go back. Let's figure out a different time.
So the Matrix Resurrections is coming out later this month. It's going to be on HBO Max and the theaters. Oh. I forgot the word of the thing, the room you used to go to watch movies on a big screen.
No one needs them anymore.
Which, by the way, I'm torn here because I saw all these Matrix movies like opening weekend on the big screen. And they are very much big screen movies. They are the special effects movie, you know? But goddamn, if it's not just the most tempting thing in the world, it's going to be on HBO Max.
That's the thing. Like, there are a lot of aspects of the movie, like going to the theater, like that whole experience that I think is awesome. And you can't replicate it at home unless you literally have a theater at your house. But the pros of just being comfortable on your couch, like we have a great TV, we have a decent sound system.
Can pause and pee.
Yeah, I could get as much tea as I want to drink.
We're wearing pajamas
freely. Yeah, you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to pay $20 each for a ticket. It's just like so many factors to where, like, yeah, the experience of like actually seeing the movie, like how the movie was intended to be watched, the most pure version is probably in the theater. And like, you know, I mentioned on our episode of Dune how I could, you know, having watched that movie on HBO Max at home, I could totally see why seeing an IMAX would be worthwhile, because that, you know, that is such a huge movie of such tremendous scale. I definitely see the value in it, but ultimately it's like, I mean, it's just the comfort level is just off the charts at home. You know what I mean?
It's I've heard you use the same comparison when like going to big wrestling events. Mm-hmm. You know, you I've taken you to the grandest ones.
Wrestling and like, especially so, because you're watching from the seat. Your view is limited to begin with.
Yes.
In the stadium or wherever you're seeing it.
So. And all the comfort factors and everything that you prefer watching it on TV. So yeah, I can see both, and I do like being part of the experience, whether it's a stadium crowd or a theater or something like that. But ultimately, we haven't really talked about it, but are we just going to watch this on HBO Max when it comes out?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, the best theater experience I ever had was when we were living in Stamford, because we were literally like a 2-block walk away from one movie theater, like the general kind of AMC movie theater, and a 3-block walk away from this like little like art house theater called the Avon Theater. So the movie like theater options in the immediate walking vicinity of our living space was so fantastic.
Yeah.
So in that case, it's like, well, I mean, I could literally just walk there so I could see the benefits. But in all other cases, like now where we are, we would have to drive 10 minutes to get to the theater and you know, pay all the money. So it's, I just want to watch it at home.
There was a real heyday with MoviePass when we lived in New York City where we were walking to the theater a lot.
New York City MoviePass.
That was. I don't think I'll ever have a period in my life where I'm seeing more movies in the theater, including maybe when I worked at a movie theater and got free movies.
Yeah, that was so much fun. We were going all the time. We definitely milked it for all it's worth while we had it. But that that like while that was actively happening, it just felt like this is not going to last.
No. Good thing I bought a bunch of stock in them. And, yeah. Oh man, I'm rolling in it now.
Not a bunch of stock. It was just like a few hundred dollars.
Yeah. It offset the value MoviePass game. But, so basically, whenever a big sequel comes out, I don't normally have the compulsion to like I have to watch every one. Like you know, it's not like before Force Awakens came out. Actually, I think we did watch all the Star Wars movies. So that's that's a terrible comparison. But you know what I mean. When there's a new movie coming out, I don't feel like I have to watch every one right beforehand. This is a major exception for me because you've never seen 2 and 3, right?
No.
Okay, I saw them both once in the theaters, and I hated them because mainly because I didn't understand them.
Okay.
It's not that they were like, I remember thinking they were objectively bad or anything, because they were like cool action scenes. Like I remember it's like doing some bold, weird stuff. Like it goes way weirder than the first one. But I remember being incomprehensible. And that's why I hated it.
Well, I mean, that is such a huge factor in the enjoyment of a movie because, you know, when we sit down and watch a movie, it has our full attention and we're not, you know, we can figure most things out, even like the more heady concepts in a movie. Like we can appreciate and enjoy really complicated films. So if a movie is, you know, the meaning or what's going on is very ambiguous and you can't, like fully understand what's going on when you feel like you should understand. I feel like not understanding when you as an audience member is supposed to be left in the dark is one thing. Cause then it's like, okay, I'm where I should be. Like there's a reason I don't understand this. I'm missing a part of the picture that I'll probably find out later on. Versus like, I feel like I should be following this and I'm not. Like that is such a immersion breaking thing. And, you know, we saw it in like Godfather 3. That was like, you know, obviously a well-directed film, but you know, it was very long, very dense, and it was very confusing and poorly told, you know? And I haven't seen the Matrix 2 or 3, which we're going to talk about that as the weeks go on here. But I would imagine maybe they got into like the more philosophical aspects of the Matrix and stuff and like meaning making and all of that. And I could see that getting like that's treading into territory that like, you know, the average person might not be able to relate to or follow. You know what I mean? The Matrix itself, like the original movie that we're talking about today, is such a like universal concept of just something as simple as like, well, what if what we're seeing isn't really here? You know, what if it's all fake versus like the, you know, religious and physical and like philosophical aspects of that kind of that kind of situation presents. You know what I mean? It's like a huge, I mean, they allude to Alice in Wonderland a lot in the movie. It's like going down the rabbit hole, like infinitely, you know?
Yeah. And that's one of the things that this first movie does so well is it does take these kind of heady concepts. And, you know, it's interesting because to me, I always thought this was so straightforward and not hard to understand or whatever, but I wonder how much we had the benefit of like, I don't know, we understood the concept of AI and played video games and things like this. Like, we kind of understood concepts of, like, a world within a world. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, you talk about the average person, you know, like, my dad, I've talked about plenty of times, left this movie and hated it so much and told me in the parking lot, like, Dan, if anyone ever tells you that movie made a lick of sense, they are lying to your face. And we're being like, Dad, it was just like they lived in, like, a computer simulation. Yeah. It's not that crazy. But leaving 2 and 3, I think I felt the way my dad did after 1. And I don't think this is one of those things where it's like there are a lot of times where a metaphor or something goes over my head or I don't understand an obvious thing a movie is doing. I feel like my experience with Matrix 2 and 3 was kind of more the norm because I don't think I've met anyone that has been like, oh, 2 and 3 are my favorite ones. Like, oh, man, they do great stuff. Like, I don't think anyone thinks they are bad movies necessarily. I think they just think it goes way too complex and odd and complicated and philosophical.
Yeah. I don't doubt your ability to interpret themes. I'm my assumption based on the fact that like it's pretty universally unliked those two movies is that it was just presented extremely poorly.
Yeah, and that's why I want to revisit these now that you know we're older and you know maybe wiser and things like that. And from what I've heard of this fourth one, from like you know Ben Hansen's probably heard 17 different podcast series about you know the pre-production of this fourth one. He told me last time we saw him in person that like, oh, I've been hearing some things that this fourth one is going to go even farther into weird, kind of more what the sequels did. So I really want to enjoy this new one. And I think if I didn't watch 2 and 3 going in, I think I'd be so lost because outside of just like the setting of some of these action sequences in the sequels, I don't remember shit that happens in those because I just remember being like, what the fuck is going on? So I feel like I kind of have to watch 2 and 3 to kind of understand it. And you, having never seen them at all, right. I think, you know, it's probably going to help you a lot to see it fresh before. So it's all to say that is our plan for the coming weeks is we are going to do episodes on 1, 2, 3. And we're going to have to look at the calendar because the fourth one comes out while we're actually separated for the holidays. So we might have to take a break and maybe have the Panty Awards in between. Mm-hmm. But regardless, you will be getting The Matrix Resurrections near the end of this year or the early next year, as well as the Panty Awards, our year-end award ceremony. But these next 3 weeks, we're pretty locked in on Matrix 1, 2, and 3. So we've watched one now.
That's right.
It's still really good.
It's an excellent movie, yeah. It's really, really good. It's, you know, there are a lot of parallels to be drawn, like, on the most macro level between this and Terminator 2, which is another one of our favorite movies.
I made that note, too, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, where it's just like, you know, war or man versus machine, where, you know, our own creation, our, you know, pride and selfishness and, you know,
hubris,
we made this own creation and then it overtook us. But in Terminator, it's more like a actual war.
It's like a physical war. These are the robots and they're fighting us.
Yeah. And in The Matrix, it's more like humanity has been enslaved by the robots, like how we previously enslaved the robots.
Yeah. And not only the AI run rampant thing, I also thought of Terminator 2 specifically, and that you've got a main bad guy who's wearing a pretty unassuming outfit, you know, the cop into the just kind of FBI mm-hmm. type guy in this one, who can kind of inhabit the bodies of other people. You mm-hmm. know, he's kind of like warping into like, I'm a helicopter. They both literally take over the bodies of helicopter pilots, mm-hmm. you know, like that kind of reminded me too. Although that I kind of like the Agent Smith character maybe even more than the T-1000. The T-1000 is great as just pure robot menace. Agent Smith is this interesting thing. Like, I forgot about like that whole speech where he's just like, I hate this place. Yeah. I want to get out of here. Mm-hmm. Like, he's like sentient to the point of like, he wants to escape the Matrix because he is trapped in there as a program, just like, you know, the people are enslaved, you know? Right. Like, yeah. That's really interesting, and I know they go far into that in 2 and 3.
Yeah, that's I really appreciated that as well. You know, I always thought of Agent Smith as just kind of this, like, you know, he is, like, the soulless evil character, but I forgot that he is, like, more fleshed out than I remember. Specifically, his drawl, like, the way yes. he talks is
so... Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, everything is, like, over-enunciated and drawn out. It's, like, very, very cold. But also, you know, very like, I don't know, it's very human sounding. It's not like overly robotic, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it sounds like Hugo Weaving had a lot of fun with this role. Like, he specifically made him kind of weird in his own. And like, this is some of the best casting I've ever seen. Because I don't think I'd ever seen Hugo Weaving before. Obviously, he would go on and do Lord of the Rings and stuff like that. But man, he is such a weird, menacing character in this. And for a sentient... weird assassin program, like, I don't think you could have cast that better.
Yeah, it's, you know, just that idea too of like these guys with their earpieces in and their opaque black sunglasses and suits, it is so menacing. Like, that is just such a menacing, like, just that visual, you know what I mean? It's, you have an automatic response seeing that.
And they build them up too with Morpheus saying like, look, I'm not going to lie to you. Every single person that has gone up against an agent has died. Mm-hmm. And it really just, it's like, if you see him run, like, everyone seems terrified of the agent. So like by the end, when Neo is literally just like standing up against them and fighting them without even thinking about it, it's like, oh shit, Neo is a badass, you know?
Yeah. When he like consciously puts his arm behind his neck.
Oh, that part's so fucking cool. There are a lot of parts in this movie. I just remember like watching on the DVDs over and over and over again, like fight scenes. Cause like, fight scenes in at least Hollywood, you know, U.S. cinema didn't look like this before The Matrix. Right. You know, like now we're so, you know, spoiled with like The Raid and, you know, Mission Impossible Fallout and like tons of these movies with just like incredible fight choreography.
Well, yeah, the fight choreography is really good, but it's more how it's shot that's really remarkable. I mean, they did a lot of the wire stuff that you see in like Crouching. Have you seen Crouching Tiger?
Oh, yeah, saw in the theaters, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They you know, that wire, like where they're lifted up on wires and float around and stuff like that. But really, where it is, where it shines and where it kind of, you know, that whole Matrix aesthetic emerged from the way it's shot, specifically like the bullet time stuff and the slow-mo, where the action would be happening in slow motion, but the camera would move at a regular or like fast speed.
It's with that I think that, like, is there a movie in our lifetimes that has been more influential across the board in entertainment than this? from like bullet time in video games. I mean, that's still a thing. Fucking mm-hmm. Red Dead has a like pause time, get all your things. Max Payne famously, right. You know, like how many movies have done in the immediate aftermath, you know, Equilibrium, the Charlie's Angels movies and stuff that like, you know, we still just call it bullet time or Matrix stuff, you know, mm-hmm. like it was so influential with that. And not just with that, it's like the way the fight scenes are in like Hollywood cinema now, you know, like file sharing app. Remember Morpheus and like, I don't know if you remember Morpheus. It was before Kazaa.
Yeah.
The vernacular of like, you know, red pill, you know, has become part of the sure. vernacular, you know, things like that. Like everything, like you still see memes and stuff of The Matrix. It is, I can't think of a more influential film in just the way like specifically action movies have been made mm-hmm. and video games, yeah. you know, like. What other movie can you point to and be like, oh, after that, a bunch of video games started doing that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, the premise is so relatable because it isn't presenting this. I mean, it is presenting, like, theoretically, this is an alternate world and not based in reality, right? But, like, it is suggesting that everything we see and we know isn't real compared to something like, you know, Gattaca, which is also mm-hmm. a phenomenal movie, but that's like a completely like different version of the future where there's, you know, this completely different way society is structured. And, you know, in this case, it's life as we know it, everything we know, it's all the same. It's just, it's not actually there. You know what I mean? So it's something that like we can all just, you know, acknowledge and like just, it immediately makes you question like, well, what if this isn't real? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And at first when they were showing the scenes within the Matrix, like in the city and everything, I was trying to think like, oh, what city was this supposed to be set in? Is this like, I was looking at the skyline. I was like, is this New York? Is this Chicago? But then I realized like it was probably a conscious decision to make it just seem like any metropolitan city in the US. Cause mm-hmm. it's like, it is relatable. Like you said, it's not some far flung future. I feel like the city scenes and stuff, it's not this like crazy New York thing that, you know, I couldn't relate to if I lived in Kansas City, you know, mm-hmm. like the city stuff is just like, here's an office building. Here's like kind of a downtown area, you know, here's his apartment. It's all kind of like very relatable and it makes you leave the theater thinking that like, oh wow, what if X, you know?
Right. Yeah. Like all these really mundane things, like what if it's just there to make this seem more legitimate yeah. and distract, you know?
Well, yeah, and the Wachowskis made most of the cast read all these books on, you know, these French books on philosophy and simulation and things like that to kind of understand it. And a lot of people struggled, it sounded like, with these kind of like really heady concepts. Like Will Smith was going to be Neo, but...
Well, he was pitched the role, yeah.
He was pitched the role and he turned it down because he didn't quite understand the concept and he was kind of skeptical of the bullet time. He thought if it looked stupid, it would make him look stupid and stuff like that. But Carrie Ann Moss had trouble understanding it. So this idea of like a world within a simulation or us living in a simulation seemed to be at the time not something that was like, I think now you could point to stuff like, oh, Second Life or an MMO or World of Warcraft or like what Facebook is talking about with the metaverse and mm-hmm. things like that. And I think these terms and concepts are more prevalent today. Mm-hmm. Whereas back then, I think people were just like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a really good point. I feel like now with like this all this metaverse stuff going on, like granted it's, you know, in 100 years, in 1,000 years, it's going to be completely different, of course. But like, you know, we're all just kind of all agreeing to this simulation of our own making. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, obviously, you know, this metaverse, if we're walking around with a VR headset in a reality that doesn't exist, looking like we don't really exist, you know, it's different if we could just willingly snap in and out of it. Yeah. The Matrix is just proposing a world in which you can't just snap out of it.
Yeah, and that whole idea of this, like this voluntary metaverse thing, I struggle to get on board with it. Because it's like, you always hear about Second Life and stuff, and we just watched, the season premiere of How To with John Wilson, and they had a part where this guy, like, sold virtual real estate in Second Life. And we saw just kind of a glimpse of that. And like, that always seemed weird to me. And then this idea of the metaverse and especially companies as big as Facebook going so hard on that is mm-hmm. just like, I don't think, like, I'm still like, I have a Quest 2 or a Meta 2 or whatever. I barely use it. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think, like, that idea, I don't think I would voluntarily sign up for like this world within a world, you know?
Well, you know, with that Second Life person and, you know, people that really love Second Life and VR stuff. And well, you know, obviously VR as it is now, it has a relatively, I don't want to say shallow offering, but it isn't to the point where you could mistake virtual reality for your own life.
Not even close. It's not a Ready Player One situation. Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, those people just, they get something out of that virtual reality that they don't get out of the real world.
Sure.
And, you know, that's, they're able to get some satisfaction out of that, you know, and I think, like Neo was always struggling with how reality just felt like something wasn't right. Like there was
splinter in your mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Like just some, this doesn't feel right. You know what I mean? It's like something's wrong. Something's missing, you know, whatever. And I feel like a lot of people try to fill that hole with, you know, this other types of reality. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was reading about how like the way humans navigate the world and interpret the world and, you know, derive meaning from it, it's all based on things that were man-made, like language and sure. stuff like that. And you know, rules of society and morals, these are all man-made things. And like, if that's all man-made and these are the things we just accept as our reality, like just putting it, taking it one little step further, it isn't that much of a stretch, you know?
Sure, sure. And so I struggle too, and I think I'm going to struggle more as we watch 2 and 3 with, I know there was supposed to be a lot of like Christianity references in this, from like obviously the name of Trinity, and this new one's called Resurrections, and some things I do remember that happened in 2 and 3 that are like pretty obvious biblical like allegories and things like that, which I guess I didn't, I was looking for it while we were watching this first one. And I mean, there was like, he kind of gets resurrected at the end when there was this prophecy and, you know, he comes back to life and fights the agents and things like that. But, and you've got kind of like a Judas thing going on with Cypher or Joe mm-hmm. Pantoliano. But watching it, did you get any kind of Christianity stuff out of this?
No, not abundantly, no. I mean, like there's the, you know, not being born from parents thing, but it's not super explicit. I think if you really try to like layer on those themes, you can make the argument, yeah. but like it didn't scream out to me, like nowhere near as much as it does for like Alex Garland sci-fi, for sure. example. He's so much more explicit with his religious allegory.
Well, now the not being born from parents thing, was Neo, did they say anything about his parents, or like everyone's born in the Matrix, you know?
They're not even like born, they're bred, the humanity.
Like they're grown in a field. That's one of the coolest yeah. shots, seeing the fields and the harvesters and stuff.
Yeah,
like, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's when Neo first wakes up from the pod and gets out of it and just looks down and looks up and just sees this infinite wall of just mm-hmm. pods and realize like, this is, I thought we were in a city, but this is,
I've been here the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, that is such a bonkers shot.
And then lines too, when he's like waking up, it's like, why do my eyes hurt? It's like, 'cause you've never used them before. And you realize like, oh shit, he's just literally been laying there the whole yeah. time in this pod.
Yeah. I feel like his muscles would have atrophied way more than like, he was yeah. still ripped and able
he's
to walk around.
He's doing kung fu pretty quick.
Yeah. Like, Beatrice in Kill Bill was in a coma for, I don't know how long, but certainly not her whole life. And she wasn't able yeah. to walk, but.
Oh, I guess, you know, he is doing all that like kung fu. He has to learn all that stuff within the Matrix. And so I guess we never really see Neo or kind of any of them in the real world on the mm-hmm. Nebuchadnezzar, they don't really partake in anything physical. So I guess that's,
except the stuff with Cypher when they have to kill Cypher and stuff. But
right.
Yeah, Neo himself doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you were able to do the thing he does when he's training, where you just kind of like download everything, like what would be, if you had a few programs you could put in, what are the first ones you would put
in?
Oh
my God, that would be so cool. Like just install like and to learn any ability mm-hmm. instantly.
Yeah, the way he's like, I want jujitsu.
I would love to be able to speak every language. Mm-hmm. I would love to be able to know some like particular martial art to like the like master levels.
Yeah,
and I guess it would be really cool to like just be able to like download old master's level of technical painting ability to my head.
Interesting. You know? Do you think if you could, something like musical instruments and things like that, is there a way, you know more about this stuff than I do, but like, could you download knowledge that could make you a great musician, or do you think a lot of that is just like innate?
Well, I mean, when you're playing an instrument, you're moving your hands around. When you're doing kung fu, you're moving your
body.
That's
true.
Like, it's still a mind-body connection. So I feel like in the movie, if we're going by the movie's rules, if you're yeah. able to install the knowledge and then replicate it with your body, like, I don't see why it would be any different for playing guitar or whatever.
That's true. Yeah, I forgot about the physical aspect of that, which there are a lot of questions that I try not to think too hard about because I wanted to just enjoy it. But it's like, okay, so these sentient programs and stuff, they can obviously manipulate the Matrix and they can move much faster. Neo had to learn it, but they can naturally do it. So like, why can't they just hack or do like a cheat code type thing to have infinite ammo? Like there are parts where like Agent Smith runs out of ammo. Mm-hmm. I guess I didn't understand why they couldn't do that. I know that they established that there are rules to the simulation and you can bend them, sometimes break them. But like, I didn't quite understand like do they just permanently live in the Matrix? And like, I don't remember if we ever see the agents outside of the Matrix in the sequels, but like, it seems to me that they always just live in there. So can they not like get to a higher level and hack in or talk on the earpiece to like a programmer in the real world or something like?
Well, I think they are like, they are the programs that are just specifically out to, you know, fix anomalies and stuff. So I think they have a command over the program to the extent that they can like, you know, they probably can't break it down completely or shut it off, but they can manipulate how things are working like as it happens around them. But like when Neo runs out of his ammo and the agent has his gun to Neo's head and Neo has his gun to the agent's head, you know, the agent says, "You're out of ammo." And then Neo says, "So are you." And then yeah. I think in that moment, like he probably wasn't out of ammo, but he made it the reality, like how the girl showed him with the spoon.
Yeah, and there is a lot of that, like, there are so many influences in this movie. It's like, there's the Christianity thing, but there's a ton of other philosophies and stuff. There's also, like, this, like, lucid dream element, too, where it's like, you know, I've talked before about lucid dreams, and it's like, there's one line from Morpheus that is directly, like, how I remember you had to think in lucid dreams, where it's like, he says something like, "Don't think you can, know you can," during the fight. And that's, like, when I would try to fly in a lucid dream, I would try to jump and then I would just like, I'd fall. And then I'd be like, "Oh, come on, I can do it. I can do it. I think I can do it." And you couldn't do it. But then you have to actually kind of stop and remind yourself that like, no, I'm in a dream. I know I can fly. I can do anything. And then it would work.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, that is straight up a lucid dream. Like that concept is the exact same where, hey, I'm in the Matrix. This isn't real. I know I can do this. You know?
Yeah. I think, you know, Neo being the one probably allows him to understand the simulated world to an extent that the other people can't, which is why he's able to like match the agents and the agent's ability to manipulate the simulated world to avoid any bullets and stuff like that and just be a total killing machine with one hand, you know?
That's another really sweet line is when Morpheus is, when Neo's like, "Oh, so you're saying I'm going to be able to dodge bullets?" And he's like, "No, I'm saying when you're ready, you won't have to." Mm-hmm. And you see that like he does dodge bullets, but then he realizes like when he has the full resurrection moment and he just says no, when he turns his head and says no and holds his hand out, that's like an all-time badass scene for me. Like, just like, oh, he just realizes I can stop all this shit.
Don't try that at home, folks.
that I think that is the moment of him knowing that he's the one, you know, like there's also that really sweet part where after the subway fight, which is incredible, that Agent Smith is like, "Oh, here comes the train. It's inevitability." And Mr. Anderson, he goes, "My name is Neo." And he just like throws him up into the ceiling, does the backflip off the platform, creams, you know, Agent Smith.
Right.
Fucking awesome.
Yeah, it was really good. Really satisfying to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I also, going back to the training, I like the how the jump program is just Richie's plank experience from VR, where it's just like, because we put it on, like we put it on our Aunt Donna and, or your Aunt Donna, and, you know, she was just like, I can't do this. Like, yeah, I can't walk off the edge of this skyscraper. Yeah. For those that don't know, Richie's plank experience is just a simulator of like standing on a plank off a skyscraper. And it's, your brain is yelling at you saying, "Don't do this." But you kind of have to do that thing where it's literally a Matrix thing where it's like, this isn't real. It feels real, but I know better. I know this isn't real and I can fall and it's fine, you know?
Yeah. I, you know, obviously I'm acutely aware that putting on a VR headset, what you're seeing in there isn't real, but even I struggle to do Richie's plank experience. And, you know, if you're within the Matrix and someone tells you to jump off a building, that's just like standing at the top of a building, like without something on your head and looking around and seeing you're on top of a 20-story building and then willingly jumping off. Like that to me would be so fucking hard.
Yeah.
And I could definitely relate to that moment a lot more having done Richie's plank experience too, because I kind of know that feeling a little bit.
It's interesting watching this now that we are in an age where like we have enough VR experiences where it's like, oh yeah, okay. Yeah. You know, I could see that. God, what else? Like most of this has dated. It's aged well, I would say. Even the special effects, which like a lot of times ambitious special effects movies are incredible at the time and don't hold up here. Here it, I mean, there's not a lot like the bug stuff, like when the bug goes in his stomach and stuff, that looks a little like, I feel like whenever there's a lot of animation in old CG, it looks a little bad.
Right.
But compared to everything else that came out in the late 90s, this is so far ahead of everything, you know?
Yeah, totally. And it also, just like aesthetically, it just so well too, because, you know, it took place in 99, which is kind of like this ambiguous, like there is no real clear cut look to 1999, you know what I mean? Plus a lot of those styles are coming back now, but the Matrix, like, black sunglasses, leather bodysuit, black trench coat is like such a timeless, like future person look. You know what I mean?
Not to mention the bad guys, just suits.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. So it was like not, it didn't feel dated in that way either.
Yeah, there are a few times where they show interfaces like screens and stuff of computers, and that very much looks like, you know, but it doesn't lean on it as hard as something like Hackers you watch now. We did an episode on that a while ago, and that is constantly showing computer screens, and it is like hilariously dated stuff. It's like playing a PlayStation 1, you know, demo disc or something. Here, there's some stuff that looks dated, but I think it's so cool that so much of it is just the Matrix code of the green, because that still looks awesome, you know? And like the way Cypher explains it is like, oh, I don't even see the code anymore. I just see, you know, what is he, blonde, brunette, redhead, you know? Like, that doesn't look dated. That's such a, I don't know if that was by design, but it makes it age pretty well, you know?
Yeah, just the green text on the black screen that's just like kind of raining down on the screen, yeah.
Yeah. I would have to imagine the new movie's not going to have as many payphones.
Probably not. That's true.
And also the soundtrack is the most 90s ass, you know, Rammstein and Rob Zombie and Rage Against the Machine.
You know, I don't really have a problem with like that.
It's good.
It's good. And I feel like it fits well. But I honestly was kind of disappointed by the original film score. It just like those orchestrations felt so generic considering how unique and futuristic the subject matter was. I feel like if this movie came out today, the soundtrack would be way better.
Yeah, you see a lot of stuff like Annihilation and Blade Runner 2049 and stuff that does like really, or Dune. Dune's soundtrack is incredible, you know? Yeah, that's a good point. I really wonder what the new movie's soundtrack is going to sound like. Huh, that's interesting to think about. One thing I thought was during the like goopy mirror part, I kind of forgot, like, I don't really get like, like, does the red pill do anything, or did, like, Morpheus just tell Tank and then Nebuchadnezzar, like, hey, if he takes the red pill, unplug him, you know? Like, does it, like, I don't think the pill would do anything. And the blue pill, it's just, like, they're sugar pills. The blue pill is like, I don't know, just stay here in the Matrix, hang out. The red pill, I tell Tank to unplug you, you
know? Well, wasn't the blue pill, like, you would forget that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, maybe he forgets to even talk to, like, he'll...
I think, like, he would might consider still continue feeling like something was off with the world, but it would just go, that feeling would go unaddressed.
That's right, yeah.
But, yeah, what would the red pill do? Because he gave him the red pill, and then he just, like, escorted him to the next room. Was that just, like, a Luden's cough drop or something?
Yeah, I don't know. They plugged him into the, or they sat him down, and there was the weird the mirror thing, which, by the way, that was extremely Death Stranding. I obviously didn't think about this earlier, but it's... The shot goes down his throat as the mirror is kind of taking over his body. So it goes into his throat all the way down, and then he's like a person in a pod naked. It's like a BB, you know, it's extremely Death Stranding.
You know what? I'm vaguely remembering them now that I think about it. I'm remembering him saying Morpheus mentioning something about how the red pill might disrupt the signals that like to your brain waves or whatever. So it
might
help facilitate the removal of you from the program.
There's some of that language that probably doesn't mean anything, but just sounds cool. Like when they're watching Neo and Morpheus fight, I think Mouse on the ship is like, oh, his neurokinetics are off the charts. It's like, okay. Neurokinetic, like brain movement. Okay, sure. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's
Listen, it's a very conceptually dense movie. I don't need to know about any of the technology.
No.
I don't need to peek behind the kimono and look at whatever this is supposed to be technically.
Just give me the concepts. Yeah. Although this was still during the era of sci-fi movies or action movies where you had to explain what an EMP is every time. So it's like, EMP, it's an electromagnetic pulse. That's it shuts down all electronics in the area.
Yeah. It's always interesting going back to these older sci-fi movies when they like explain things that are so commonplace now, like that idea. Yeah. Even just the idea of like a computer network, you know?
Yeah. All these computers, I can send an email and yeah. The Morpheus glasses never caught on. The ones without the ear sticks there.
Yeah.
Yeah. They seemed pretty cool back then.
What would they just like clip on to the bridge of the nose?
I guess so. You see that every once in a while, like Asuka's mask, but I think she bites a thing. Like you can't bite sunglasses.
I've always wanted sunglasses that were like totally black, opaque like that, you know, but I don't want them to be mirrored. I don't like the mirror because I don't want to like be wearing them and then someone's talking to me and then they could just look at their face while they're looking at me.
That'd be distracting and weird.
Because I've spoken to people who are wearing like mirror glasses like that before and it's very distracting because I don't want to just look at my face while I'm talking to someone.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And that's naturally where you look.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So everyone keep that in mind when you're wearing those.
My question throughout a lot of this was like, why is Morpheus so convinced that Neo is the one?
Yeah.
You know, because like all he knows before they meet is that he's a hacker and that he's obviously like curious about this. Like, you know, he's getting these messages about the Matrix and he doesn't quite know what it is. But what does he demonstrate? Like, I can't remember if two or three goes into this at all, but like the Oracle has her prophecies, which It's unclear whether the Oracle actually thinks Neo is the one, or if she just told him he wasn't because he needed to believe himself. You know what I mean? Like,
well, Morpheus told Neo that the Oracle will tell him whatever he has to hear.
Yeah.
So it's possible that, like, I mean, I guess what the movie was trying to suggest was that, like, you know, she was just saying that because he needed to have that, like, feeling that he wasn't the chosen one to then overcome the adversity necessary to get to the point where he could be, like, have that revelation that he is the one. He yeah. needed to have it proven to him before he can, like, truly believe that.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's something more like how, you know, Neo, Morpheus, Trinity, these were all their, like, hacker names. If it's, he, like, proved some, at some point in his hacking career that he was the one somewhere along the lines. But yeah, they never really expand on, like, how they specifically thought that, like, it was him out of all the legions of pod people out there.
Yeah. And all the, like, young kids who are bending spoons, making blocks float and stuff like yeah. that, you know, it's unclear.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Oracle stuff is cool. I can't remember if they go into that more in 2 or 3. Just this, like, all-knowing, you know, woman that they go to. And, you know, it's a lot of prophecy. Trinity falling in love with a dead man mm-hmm. and things like that.
Oh, that was the other thing that I kind of had took umbrage with. Like, the Trinity-Neo love arc, like, there's nothing that happens in the story that would suggest that there's any kind of love percolating. And then all of a sudden she's like, I'm in love with you. It's like, out of where? You guys haven't even had a conversation.
That's the thing that I definitely didn't notice as a teenager seeing this, but definitely noticed this time. Yeah. Because I think back then it was just more just like, that's how movies are. The guy and the girl fall in love at the end. You know, it's just like you don't bat an eye at it. But now it's just like, I don't know, we've seen a lot of movies and just time has moved on and we've gotten older and stuff. And now it's just like, I think about that where it's just like, wait, there's not even a moment of flirtatiousness.
No,
in this,
you know? Like they didn't have any like times where they were sitting back and laughing with each other. Like, listen, Trinity, most you have like a little crush on him.
Yeah.
You're not in love with
right.
him.
Right. That's the thing. Like, if I had to criticize something about the movie watching it now, it's that like a lot of the dialogue and just interactions and stuff, it's not very natural. There's no real kind of moments of like levity or human interaction or anything like that. It's all very just like heady, like this is the desert of the real, like stay in Wonderland. It's all very heady. It works for this movie. I think in a worse movie I would have been like rolling my eyes at it, but you really don't get much of a sense of like these people, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it probably could have been benefited from like more like front-loaded like background about Thomas Anderson, like who he is. And you know, we learn a little bit that he's like, you know, doesn't do well with authority or whatever. We learn that from his office job, but like we don't know who he is as a person and how that like maybe some aspect of his personality would lead us to determine why he is the one, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
we're not really given that. But
the anti-authority thing's a little ham-fisted too, where it's like, how about I give you the finger and then you give me my phone call? It's just like, okay, this is very 90s edge going on here. Yeah. But again, it all works. Like I can excuse all of it because it pays off all these concepts so well. It's like the first half is setting up the rules in the world, and the second half is just like, all right, now let's just go fucking bonkers with the action. Mm-hmm. And there are like, it's just iconic shot and moment after iconic shot and moment. I forgot how awesome the helicopter part is, where the helicopter's crashing and Trinity grabs big like harness or strap or whatever, and the shot where it's all exploding and rippling out behind her. Like, also, there's a lot now that I've seen some anime where I'm just like, oh, okay, I can definitely see the anime influence here. There's some anime-ass shit going on
here.
Yeah,
a lot of Ghost in the Shell and Akira influence, in the visuals especially.
Yeah, which, you know, they very openly talked about that influence and even put that, like, Enter the Animatrix or whatever DVD out. And that was back in a time when, like, mainstream, I don't think anyone was ever talking about anime, you know? So, like, this was just so far ahead of the curve in so many different ways. And it's putting a lot on the new one to hope that it can capture even a bit of this, because like, man, this captured something at a time where it did not exist and knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
And didn't even follow up with its own sequels. But like, I just want to get even a hint of just that. Like, I don't want this to just be the same Matrix. I kind of am excited by the idea of this one being the new one being bold and weird. You know?
And I hope it's smart and it's not just overly referential. You know what I mean? It's not just purely trying to capitalize on nostalgia. That's what I hope, but that's also what I fear, that it's going to be a lot of that. But
I kind of hope that like the Wachowskis have shown that with 2 and 3 that they were willing to get bold and weird and different and not just lean on the same stuff. And obviously with this first one, they did bold and weird and different. So like, I would hope that the Wachowskis are kind of past that, you know, as filmmakers, and hopefully they are. I haven't seen pretty much any of their stuff. They made a Speed Racer after this. They made Bound and Assassins before this. I think I've just seen this stuff.
I want to see Bound. That's on my list of movies to watch.
I remember that people were talking about that when it came out.
Yeah, I remember. That's really good. I hear it's like way better than you think it's going to be.
Mm.
Like, because it's like Gina Gershon and some other hot lady, like some like...
It's her and Jennifer Tilly, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of... I mean, Gina Gershon, that's all you have to know.
Yeah, I remember seeing pictures in Entertainment Weekly and being like, I should see this movie, but I can't have mom around. Yes, I don't know what it's about, but I know I want to see this. I do remember the first time I even heard of The Matrix. I was at Tanner's Bar and Grill watching the Super Bowl with my father in Kansas, and the ad came on, the Super Bowl ad. And I remember just being like, I mean, I guess I would have been like 14, 15 at the time, probably 14. And that's the right age for this movie. And like, I just remember seeing these shots and the trailer. They showed the bullets slowing down. They showed the, you know, the famous like dodging the bullets backwards type thing. And I was just like, what the fuck is this? I have to see this. And it was very early internet marketing stuff, kind of around the same time Blair Witch was doing stuff where they had this whatisthematrix.com and they were doing kind of this like mystery thing. And it just felt different and modern and cool. And then I remember seeing it and it just blew me away. It took all those concepts and just blew my fucking mind.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. For all the amazing like visual effects, it definitely had the plot to back it up. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It wasn't all just show. It wasn't all flash. It's a very substantial movie.
Yeah.
I have vague memories as well of seeing it when I was a kid. It came out in 99, so I would have been like eight or seven when it came out. And, I remember seeing it with my dad, and my brothers. I think we were in North Carolina or something, but I just remember my dad being confused and being like, this is a movie that you really have to like not talk during and really pay attention to. And I don't think when I was a kid and I saw it, I don't think I understood it at all.
There's a bunch of cool stuff to look at.
Yeah. I think that like a 9-year-old seeing The Matrix now for the first time would have a much greater understanding of it because these like, it's a pretty simple concept and it's, you know, I know this movie had a reputation, for being like complicated and stuff, but it really isn't that hard to follow.
And kids today are making their own like Minecraft and Roblox servers and stuff like that. Like these concepts are not out of the mainstream at this point, especially for kids, you know? Oh man. Yeah. It's fun. Cause like all the big moments still blew me away in this, but then there were all the tiny little things that I remember watching a million times that I forgot about. Like when they're fighting, he's fighting Smith at the end and he blocks the punch, Smith does. And then Neo just like puts his fingers out and Smith's like, just like hits him in the neck. I'm like, oh, right. I remember just like marking out for that part as a kid. And this was also like the first DVD for just about everyone my age, because DVDs have been around for a few years, but they were kind of expensive and out of reach. DVD players were, but the PlayStation 2 came out in October of 2000. And that's, you know, aroundish the time. So basically, as soon as everyone got a PS2, they're like, oh, the coolest looking movie of all time is going to be my first DVD.
Yeah.
And that was the first one I ever bought too. Which, ironically, PlayStation was my first Blu-ray as well, because PS3 had the Blu-ray player, and it came with Talladega Nights. So I'm willing to bet there are a lot of people who had Matrix as their first DVD and Talladega Nights as their first Blu-ray, thanks to Sony and PlayStation. So, man, it's very, very few movies have the cultural impact and also, like, personal impact on me as a teenager seeing it. Like, there are other ones, like Fight Club was around the same time, and Fight Club definitely blew my mind as a teenager, but I feel like watching Fight Club now would be a much different experience. I'm sure I could still, you know, appreciate Fincher's direction and a lot of the performances and things like that, but like I remember thinking it was like super deep philosophy, and like this the concept of this movie is still really thought-provoking and cool today, whereas I bet Fight Club would be a little more like, oh, I don't think I quite understood what this was doing as a teenager. You know?
Yeah, it definitely speaks to, like, that time that, like, the cultural zeitgeist back then was very much, like, a lot of, like, rage and a lot of questioning, you know, people questioning their place in the world and in society and how it operates and you know. It's a lot of, like, disillusioned young, I guess that would have been Generation X people, you know?
Yeah.
Who definitely suffered under the indulgence of the baby boomer era.
Mm-hmm.
They suffered from their ability to just kind of like sit back and not face any real
war, you know, or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Our Great Depression is our lives.
Yeah. And then, you know, consequently they were able to have their mind go to philosophical things because they weren't pressed by material needs. But, you know, obviously culture has benefited with all these amazing movies that we've gotten out of it.
Yeah. And if, like, you know, Matrix and Fight Club specifically both dealt with, like, kind of disillusionment with the world and things like that. I just think, you know, 20 something years later, I think the Matrix's approach to that theme rings more true. Not more true, but it resonates still more than Fight Club does, maybe.
I almost wonder if the name Matrix Resurrections suggests, like, that it's going to be more heavy-handed with the religious stuff.
Have you seen the trailer?
I haven't. I didn't want to watch anything before.
Good. Maybe keep it that way, because it's like, it's not what I expected. It's like, I think it's going to be fucking weird.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm into it. And you know what? I'm excited for these next couple episodes. We'll do Matrix 2 and 3 in the coming weeks. I'm going to go in totally blank slate. I'm, you know, 20 years removed or whatever, and just try to enjoy it, try to understand it, and then we'll talk about it. How's that sound?
That sounds perfect.
Great. Well, folks, I hope you will join us on that ride. And I want to give a special shout out to our patrons. That is at patreon.com/panningthestream. We keep it real simple for you. Just one $5 tier a month.
That's it.
Gets you ad-free episodes.
Wow.
Gets you early episodes.
Wow.
Gets you access to our Discord.
Wow.
Happening Discord.
It's very happening.
It is very happening. There's a lot of people in there. It's very fun. And also, most importantly, gets for you, custom made for you by Bonk. Hey, Bonk, ooh, Bonk, do we have someone this week?
We sure do, Daniel.
Who do we have?
This week, we are honoring our friend Peter.
Peter.
Peter? Peter Pumpkin Eater?
Perhaps. We don't know.
This Bonk ooh is for you. The gears were spinning. The engine began to cry. Peter's work was done.
Oh, okay. I think that one, it's usually really good or really bad. I think this is just speaks to him being maybe a diligent worker.
He's a good mechanic.
He's a good mechanic. There you go, Peter. Things could have gotten much worse for you based on previous bonkers.
That's true. You really lucked out. It's bad. It's bad for you, usually.
Yes. Well, thank you, Peter. We look forward to coming back to talk to you all next week about Matrix 2 and 3. Thanks to Tom Monda for the theme song. Bonk, you want to plug your brother's business he's got going on?
Thank you, scientists. New EP, Plague Accommodations, coming in at 20 minutes and 20 seconds. That's no coincidence, folks. Catch them on tour for the next 2 months. They're coming to a city near you. Show your support for Tom Monda, and thank you, scientists, and all their musical endeavors.
There you go, folks. Thank you to Tom. Thank you to Bonk. Thank you to all you listening. We will be back next week. Bye.